brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you? Welcome to Stuff You Should Know from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuck Bryant getting on down with his bad self. Get on down, Matt Tical.
Doing the hustle.
Oh, is that what you're doing?
Sure. Yeah. I actually looked up the hustle because I wasn't quite sure what it was specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, because no one who does it now knows what they're doing.
Yeah, but then I saw it and I was like, oh, yeah, sure. The, like, sort of the boogie night stance they did was
close. Isn't there like a hand rolling?
Yeah, there's a little step up, little step back, little side 360, clap, clap. Little John Travolta, Saturday Night Fever hand action.
Uh-huh.
Little hand roll. The little, what do you call that? This would be much better visually.
I'll tell you what. Why don't we get you doing just a quick how-to video and we'll post it. Sound good?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Well, you'll be held to that.
I know.
That's
I'll do
great.
It.
I'm going to go start looking for clothes right after this. Chuck, you doing well?
Yes.
Feeling invigorated by the presidential... executive orders episode.
Yeah,
man. You ready for this?
Fires me up for disco.
So for disco, let's start at the end. I thought that Molly did a very good job with this. This is
agreed.
A Molly Edmonds jam.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There was a night in 1979. It was July 12th in Chicago, and it was the White Sox playing the Tigers, and both of them were lousy at the time.
Yeah.
The night before, there had been 15,000 people. For the Tiger Sox, there's a doubleheader today, and they expected something like 6,000.
Yeah.
Right? I guess the owners of the White Sox had started to create these promotions, and one of them, that night, on July 12th, had been created by a rock DJ named Steve Dahl, who's a Chicago DJ.
Yeah, I looked him up, actually. He was fired. This is why he was so angry. He was fired by a station that switched to disco.
Oh.
He got a job at the competing rock station, WLUP 98 FM,
uh-huh.
Which is why it was 98 cents.
The Loop.
That was The Loop, actually.
The Loop.
Yeah. Not The Lube, The Loop.
The Lup.
Okay. Yeah, so yeah, anyway, he got fired and said, down with disco.
Well, he said, disco sucks.
Yeah.
There was a whole movement against disco. T-shirts that said disco sucks. This is before memes.
Yeah.
This was the real, like, you had to, like, run out of your house, go across the street to a neighbor's house, tell them disco sucks.
Yeah.
And they had to run out of their house, maybe a couple blocks over to their friends. That's how things spread back then.
Yeah.
And this thing was, like, virulent, right?
I miss those times.
On this night, even with this this disco demolition night is what they called it. They were expecting like 6,000 people, but they were going to put on a heck of a show. In between the two games, Dahl was going to take all the records that people brought. If you brought a disco record, you'd get in for 98 cents because that was 98 point something.
Yeah. This is before it was point. This is when it was just 98 on your dial.
Oh, okay.
I mean, technically it was, but it wasn't digital, so no one knew.
Gotcha.
You know what I'm saying? And 90,000 people showed up.
90,000 people showed up. Like, 90,000. The stadium held like 52. Right? 52,000. So there's like 38,000 people outside the gates. When you have 38,000 people who are there to see something destroyed,
yeah.
which Dahl was going to do these records in between games,
mm-hmm.
They don't usually stay outside of gates. Fences don't usually contain people in that state in that many large a number.
Yeah.
They broke through. Apparently, players on both teams put on their batting helmets because the crowd was getting crazy.
Well, they were throwing the records like frisbees. They were
that's dangerous.
Smoking weed in the stadium, like Harry Carey. You know, a younger Harry Carey announced that, you know, like he smelled marijuana in his broadcast booth.
Wow!
And they got loaded, and because they were mad, so angry about a form of music.
Right. So the first game ends. And I guess what you would call halftime comes, and Steve Dahl, compiles 10,000, an estimated 10,000 disco records, and sets them on fire.
Well, he exploded them first.
Oh, he did.
Which took out like a chunk of the field.
Yeah, I was wondering how they did that.
Yeah, they were. He was hooked up to pyrotechnics, and it was a big explosion. And
10,000 disco records went boom.
Yeah, pretty much. And a little fire started.
People went crazy.
Yeah.
They trashed the place.
Yeah, they stormed the field.
And the Sox had to forfeit the second game to the Tigers because they couldn't play. The field was just too trashed. And that was the night, July 12th, 1979, that most people point to when they say disco died right then.
Yeah. Chants of disco sucks.
Yeah. People smoking weed in front of Harry Carey.
Yeah. And consequently, that was the last forfeited Major League Baseball game in the American League.
Oh, is that right?
The most recent, that is.
That is an amazing story.
Yeah.
But, and it makes a lot of sense.
You can find video of this on YouTube, by the way.
There was a, well, that's awesome. There was definitely, even I knew, like there was an anti-disco, disco sucks sentiment.
I remember it. That's how old I am.
Well, I remember it too.
Yeah. I was like 8 years old when this happened.
I was like three.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was three. I was actually, this was 3 days before my third birthday. This all went down.
Look at that.
I don't remember this happening, but I knew people said disco sucked, like an airplane. When the plane's like making that crazy landing, they knock out a tower where the DJ's like saying, where disco lives forever.
Right.
I knew people hated disco, but now reading this and figuring out that the disco was this amazing cultural phenomenon and unpacking like the story behind it and the motives of hating it and all that. It's really, really interesting. It's not as cut and dry as, like, you know, Ted Nugent thinks disco sucks, so disco sucks. Maybe Ted Nugent is a homophobe. Huh? That's what cultural critics would say now, and we'll get into that.
We will.
Not Ted Nugent specifically, but anyone who thought disco sucks, it's not so cut and dry as
Ted
just
Nugent.
The music.
It was Ted Nugent.
Yeah, I figured.
You know what I would liken this to?
What?
Zoot Suits.
Oh, yeah, good one.
The interesting history, then it turns out there was like racial and misogynistic, well, not misogynistic in Zoot Suits, but in the case of disco, yes.
Yeah. Misogynistic, homophobic.
Yeah.
Basically, the straight white establishment does not like flashy dressing.
Yeah, and they don't like them New Yorkers.
Yeah, well.
In their bars where they dance with their shirts off.
Yes.
That kind of thing.
E.g., gay clubs.
Yeah. All right. So let's get into the music, and then we'll get into the politics.
Oh, okay. So what was, Chuck, the first disco record, do you think?
Disco Duck? No?
No.
Dolly Parton?
No. Disco Dolly? No.
No. She actually did some disco-tinged stuff.
I know. So did the Grateful Dead. Everybody did. It sucked everyone.
Carole King, Barbara Streisand. It's amazing the people that got caught up in this disco wave.
Disco Christmas, Disco Star Wars.
Oh, dude. Yeah.
Yeah, disco was huge. From when?
From what? 1970?
74 to 79.
Oh, well, yeah.
Was when it was huge.
Yeah. But some trace the beginnings of disco to the early parties in New York thrown by David Mancuso, these invitation-only parties that he had at his place called The Loft.
Yep.
Legendary first party called Love Saves the Day. They were themed.
LSD.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there was a store in the East Village called Love Saves the Day. I don't know if it's still there.
Okay.
It's like bric-a-brac. Like,
everything's coated in acid, though.
Kind of like Junkman's here in Atlanta.
Gotcha.
That kind of thing. So a lot of people trace it to Mancuso and in those early parties, which later on was sort of the precursor to what raves would be.
Right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And Mancuso kind of created this... this foundation that would become kind of the basis of disco, which was, it was DJ driven.
Yeah.
And the DJ didn't just, like, one song didn't just fade out and they're like, okay, it's time for the next one and put on another record. Mancuso actually dropped a bunch of money on a sound system that allowed him to cut back and forth between records. And he also liked to basically just use all sorts of different music.
Yeah.
And create this whole really cool set.
The music never stopped, basically.
No, it didn't. So that was kind of this basis that you'll see turn up later in hip hop. But first, it appears in disco.
Sure.
But yeah, he started throwing these parties in 1970. But I've read sources that say it goes back even further than that.
Oh, really?
1960, Le Club was opened in New York. In 1965, Arthur was opened.
These were dance clubs?
They were, because they were DJ-driven. And that was like, that's one of the bases of disco.
Sure.
Is the DJ. And there's this guy named Terry Knoll. And he went off, he became probably the first DJ.
I know that name, don't I? Or do I?
Maybe. I mean, he's pretty big. I mean, he's like the godfather of DJing.
Yeah, I might know him. I don't know DJs that much, though.
But so that he branched off and he started working at gay clubs.
Uh-huh.
And gay clubs is where disco really started to emerge.
Yeah.
So if you go back far enough, at about the same time that Mancuso was throwing his parties,
yeah,
the gay clubs had like DJs playing Philly Soul.
Yes, in New York City specifically.
Yep, which is where they think that disco originally came from. It's probably Philadelphia Soul.
Yeah, Philadelphia Soul. If you listen to works by, like some people claim that things like Barry White's Can't Get Enough of Your Love, Babe.
Or his Love Theme from 1973.
Yeah, those very much sound like disco, even though they were R&B soul singers. The same with like Isaac Hayes.
Right, but that is funk. Clear and simple, right? Isaac Hayes is definitely funk.
Sure.
And a lot of people rightly attribute the death of funk to disco. Like, they both had this moment, and disco just won out.
Yeah.
It's easier to dance to, for one reason.
Should we listen to the Barry White?
Yeah.
Which one?
This is Love's Theme from 1973. And you can hear, like, the big orchestral sound.
Right, right.
With, like, the four on the floor beat. So that's, people say that may be the first disco one. Another one is Jerry Butler's One Night Affair. And this guy, this song really shows that disco hybridized out of Philadelphia Soul.
Right.
If that's true, then this is the purest evidence of it. You under my skin, cause I don't want to be hurt again. And then one more. Do you mind?
No, no.
So this one is from Cameroon, a guy named Manu Dibango.
From the island of Cameroon?
The country.
Is it an island?
No, it's not. It's landlocked.
Well, you know, if it was surrounded by water, it'd be an island.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's just Cameroon we're going with. His name is Manu Dibango, and he released a track called Soul Mikasa. And Soul Mikasa is noteworthy because a lot of people say it's the first disco song. Well, let's hear it. So you hear it's like very clearly Cameroonian.
Yeah.
It's very African.
Yeah.
It's got that tribal beat, but it's also disco-y. The reason why people point to that song, which was released in 1972, is because a year later, a Rolling Stone rock critic or music critic named Vince Aletti put a paper, pen to paper, and described that the reason behind this obscure Cameroonian song's popularity is because of this new thing that's going on out in Queens and the Bronx, and all the hip kids are doing it, and we don't know what it's called, so let's just call it disco. And that was the first mention. He coined the term disco as applied to this music.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was the first written description of disco.
Ah.
Vince Aletti, 1973.
So I think we failed to mention that disco obviously is short for discotheque, which is the French term for nightclub.
For a nightclub where you listen to canned music.
Right.
Rather than a live
band.
And
you still hear that and see that when you go all over Europe. You still hear like, discotheque, yes?
Right, right.
Guys trying to get you in there, you know?
Yeah.
It's pretty great.
That was a pretty good impression.
Some nameless country. I don't even know what that was. Eastern Bloc. Let's just go with that.
I would have guessed like Morocco.
Oh, okay. Whatever it sounded like, that's what I was doing.
So the you just kind of said something very important, that a discotheque, one of us just said it, that a discotheque is a dance club where there's no band.
Yeah.
And this flew in the face of the rock establishment at the time.
Oh, sure.
Who were still, like, very much entrenched in the 60s.
Dude, they
were,
Jimi Hendrix and Led Zeppelin and, like...
You went and saw them.
Yeah.
That was the point. Like, you went and saw their show, and when they weren't touring, you listened to their records at home and sat on beanbag chairs.
Yeah, and worshipped at their feet.
Exactly. Disco was different. And the reason disco is different is because nobody cared... They didn't want to hear your live band. They went to go see the DJ.
Yeah, and that had a big impact on record sales because people weren't, you know, it was one-hit wonder after one-hit wonder.
Exactly.
For the most part. There were, you know, quite a few that had multiple hits. But
Donna Summer,
but
BG's,
they were still like...
Few and far between.
Yeah, and they were confined to the disco era.
Right.
Not too many lasted beyond unless they were like crossing over to begin with. Like
right.
Dolly Parton or Carole King. Or,
right, gotcha.
Barbra Streisand. But you will hear, you know... Since 1974, with Rock the Boat by the Hughes Corporation,
mm-hmm.
which, speaking of one-hit wonder,
mm-hmm.
A lot of people say that's when it really, really took off. Le Freak by Chic.
And Good Times by Chic.
Good Times. Oh, did they do that?
Mm-hmm.
I Will Survive, of course, the classic anthem by Gloria Gaynor. Funky Town, Casey and the Sunshine Band with their multiple hits.
Yeah, they were another... group, disco group.
Get Down Tonight, Shake Your Booty.
Yeah.
Classic songs.
I'm Your Boogeyman.
Play That Funky Music. Wild Cherry.
That song.
I do too.
Hate that song.
No, I really do too. That's up there with Bad to the Bone for me.
Hey man, George Thorogood is A-OK. There's nothing that guy did that stunk.
Except for that.
God, Play That Funky Music is so...
I told you George Thorogood worked out with me at the YMCA in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Like... Not with me.
The last time we had this argument, you told me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And you still maintain that he stinks, even though he...
No, I don't maintain he stinks. I think George Thorogood's awesome.
Oh, you still maintain he's good. That's what I meant.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you're wrong. Philadelphia Soul, Josh, is where it was born.
We talked about that.
I know. And Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff.
Well, yeah. So, like, if you didn't have one hit... You didn't have groups, generally, that people followed or whose records they bought. You had one-hit wonders, so singles were kind of big. And you had DJs, people went to specific clubs to see specific DJs, and you had producers. People would find out like what song a producer was making, and then they'd go listen to that.
Right, like Gamble and Huff,
right.
who can't remember the name of their company, but it was Philadelphia something, and it was all about Philadelphia Soul. It started in the Philadelphia Soul movement, like previous in the 60s, and... pretty much dwarfed Motown for a little while.
Yeah.
Which was a big deal at the time.
Yeah, and Motown was still huge.
Yeah, Berry Gordy and Motown took a hit when disco came around.
There was also a Giorgio Moroder. He was huge. He was a huge disco guy. He actually produced Donna Summers. And then the K's, they created Sasol Records, which is a pretty big disco label.
Well, Gamble and Huff... you know their work if you don't know their names, and they wrote songs like Ain't No Stopping Us Now.
That's a good one.
Love Train.
That's a great one.
And The Sound of Philadelphia, TSOP, which you might not recognize by title, but you might recognize by the fact that it is also the Soul Train theme.
That is a very, very good song.
Very good song.
That's surprisingly good. I remember Fresh Air played that when Don Cornelius died.
Oh, yeah. I bet.
R.I.P.
And
also, can I just interject one thing?
Yeah, yeah.
If you're bored right now, or I should say, of course you're not bored right now, friends. After the podcast, if you find yourself bored, go check out Moonshoes Boogie Land. I think those four words are actually just two words on YouTube, and you will be treated to an awesome new, I guess, acid disco track over... just laid perfectly over the Soul Train, like the march, the procession thing, they did.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just clip after clip of that. And
it's great.
You will be surprised to see a young rerun in the first couple of minutes.
I think I've seen that clip.
I think you have too.
I've seen him on Soul Train.
Yeah, where he just falls on his butt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, that stuff was good. I mean, how do you move like that? I couldn't do any of those moves.
No, I couldn't either. Moonshoes Boogie Land.
Yeah, and you know what? Also, if you're a little young, but you're a Star Wars fan, you don't remember the Mecco, Star Wars, and other galactic funk, go check that out. It's on YouTube. It's pretty amazing to hear the Star Wars score orchestral arrangement to disco, and it was a big, big hit.
That well, that's not the only one. Arthur Fiedler from the Boston Pops, he did A Night on Bald Mountain to disco.
Uh-huh.
There was, I can't remember who made it, but it's on the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack, Fifth of Beethoven.
Yeah, oh yeah, sure.
People love to take classical stuff and disco-fy. They disco-fied everything. Like you said, Dolly Parton, Star Wars, Disco Duck. Sesame Street had not one, but two disco albums, disco Christmas albums. Disco is everywhere. And even if you do say disco sucks, you cannot say that musically, disco sucks. Musically speaking, disco does not suck. It is difficult to play. It includes generally tough orchestral arrangements. And while it may be repetitive, and if you went and saw your favorite disco performer play in a club, they were just lip syncing.
Yeah.
It's still, initially, it was difficult to make.
Yeah, I think where disco takes the biggest knock from music, rock music fans is lyrically.
Right, and for good reason.
Sure.
So disco, we were saying it was it flew in the face of rock, the rock scene in Manhattan at the time.
Yeah.
In part because it was out in the Bronx, out in Queens.
Mm-hmm.
It was very popular among the working class.
Yeah. Latinos.
Latinos, Italians. It spread out of the gay clubs.
Yeah.
So white gay dudes in underground clubs dancing to music created by black people, black groups, and then mixed in with working class Italians and Latinos in that same club. That was disco. And that is not what the rich kids in Manhattan were doing at the time, rocking out.
Well, yeah, and that's a point that a lot of people were misguided in saying at one point that disco was of the bourgeois because Studio 54 transformed from a dance club of the people to a dance club of the elite.
Right.
And everyone started grooming, over-grooming and dressing to the nines and spending all this money.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, they did
that's
before.
Not, yeah, but
Once the rich people got involved, it was like, you can't keep up with that.
Yeah. And but it started out as very much a music of the people.
Yeah.
And like we said, Disco Fever was like, they were doing the hustle in retirement homes.
Yeah.
Like disco classes. My parents took disco dance lessons.
Yeah.
And my dad does not take disco dance lessons, yet he did.
That's pretty interesting.
Like, that's how big it was.
Well, I mean, if you go back and watch, like, Saturday Night Fever, for example, that's some pretty good dancing in there.
Yeah, oh, of course.
I'll bet your dad was, like, 80% sexier when he was taking disco lessons.
He probably was.
So, we've got this thing, and it's weird. I think it bears repeating, Chuck. Like, when you think of disco these days, you think of Studio 54.
Yeah.
You think of cocaine, which is, they were symbiotic.
Yeah, Quaaludes.
Yeah. You think of the beautiful and the rich in Manhattan.
Yes.
Right? But like you said, that's not how it started out. It was working class. It crossed ethnic lines. Gays were involved. And it basically was co-opted and usurped. And then all of a sudden, now there's a division between it. And the people who were criticizing it before really started to speak up, meaning the rockers. And they really had a point. Like you said, the lyrics, Fly Robin Fly, who cares?
Yeah.
And the other part of the problem was disco was meant for escape. Like, it was set in this time of economic hardship. New York City was hit particularly hard.
It was about
hard.
Getting out there and dancing your frustrations out.
And forgetting everything.
Yep.
The problem is while you're dancing, politicos don't dance.
Right.
And while everybody else is dancing, they're just doing whatever they want.
Yeah.
And no one's paying attention because they're dancing. So, especially once it crossed over to the rich and became like divided by class, rockers really started to have some ground to stand on by saying disco's vapid and politically and apolitical, and it sucks for those reasons. And it started to become true after that point.
Right, right. Have you ever seen Summer of Sam?
No.
Good one.
Is it?
Yeah, that's the Spike Lee one about the Son of Sam killings, but beyond, it's more a movie about that time and period in New York City in that summer than it is about this. I mean, Son of Sam figures in.
Right.
Like, huge, but it really just captures that time period.
I'll have to check
nicely.
It out.
It's good.
And plus, that John Leguizamo.
Saturday Night Fever changed everything, Josh. 1977. Great, great movie.
Did you read the article?
Yeah, I read the article, and I've seen the movie probably five or six times.
So I read the article recently, like yesterday.
Yeah.
It's called The Tribal Rights of the New Saturday Night. It was written in 76 by a guy named Nick Cohn, and it was the cover story of New York Magazine, right?
Mm-hmm.
He made it up.
Oh, really?
Did you know that?
No.
Apparently in 1994, he came out to The Guardian and said, like, I fabricated everything. Tony didn't exist.
Wow.
No, Vincent, the main guy, didn't exist. He said he made up practically the whole thing. Like, he'd just gotten to New York and, like, just started hanging out and just wrote the thing.
Wow. I can't believe he made it all up.
He did.
Crazy. Great movie, though, and famous for not only the dancing, great story, coming-of-age story,
yeah.
And the suit. The white suit.
With the black shirt.
The black shirt.
It wouldn't have popped nearly as much without that black shirt.
Oh, no. And the white vest, which Gene Siskel owned for a while. Did
really?
You know that? Yeah.
It's now at the a museum of music in, I think, New York.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, Siskel cleaned up on it. He bought it in 78 because he was such a huge fan of the movie. Bought it for $2,000, sold it in 1995 for $145,000.
Nice.
Yes.
That fat cat.
And he's no longer with us.
I know.
Okay. But the clothing was a huge deal. The fashion of disco was arguably as important as... It was just all a part of the scene. It was all intermingled.
Yeah.
The polyester, the spandex, the tight clothes, revealing as much skin as you can... Jewelry, leopard prints, it was like out of control.
Yeah.
And it's kind of come back, of course, like all fashion does.
Yeah, well, especially with that early 80s throwback that's going on or that was going on.
Yeah.
Now I think we've reached mid to late 80s, like the Fresh Prince years.
Yeah, what does it take, 20 years supposedly or something like that?
Supposedly.
So grunge is next, I guess. We'll be flying the flannel soon.
I'm not looking forward to that.
I still got my flannel. I'll be gum covered.
You're like, hey, I'm hip.
You talked about Studio 54, which is now still called Studio 54, but it's a theater.
Huh.
Another popular club. If you live in New York, you might be walking by these places and not even realize it.
Yeah, like the Sanctuary, which uh-huh. became Limelight,
yep.
made famous in Party Monster. That's now like a church that you can shop in.
Well, Paradise Garage, very famous mm-hmm. On King Street in New York, very famous discotheque, is now Verizon.
Mm-hmm. Is it really?
Yeah.
Man.
Xenon on West 43rd. Xenon was a huge discotheque, and it is now the Stephen Sondheim Theater.
Okay, well, you can do worse than that.
Exactly. So if you're walking around New York and you see these places, just remember there was a lot of drugs and sex and dancing going on there.
Yeah.
30-plus years ago.
Yeah. People forgetting their economic turmoil troubles.
That's right.
So we said that, well, you said that the record industry kind of took a hit. Because of disco.
Yeah, people weren't out buying their albums by their favorite artists because there were no favorite artists.
No, and there was like, it took a little while for the effects to show up, but from like 1978 to 1982, record sales dropped by like 200 million units.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
That is a lot.
And so the record industry turned on disco eventually. This thing that had created this kind of vapid... very quick, very attractive, sexy movement
mm-hmm.
or help promote it and push it out into the mainstream like and shove down everybody's throats were the ones that turned their back on it.
Right.
I don't think people were quite ready to yet, but the record industry was. And that probably more than anything led to disco's demise, more than this Comiskey Park thing. I mean, that's like a...
It was symbolic.
It was very symbolic. But
yeah.
If the record industry is no longer agreeing to produce disco records...
Yeah.
There's no disco records.
That's what's
going to
kill
it. It doesn't
disco.
Matter if people want it or not.
And, you know, looking back, it was bound to be a fad. It's not a lasting thing. Okay. Although, it's come back around now with stuff like Scissor Sisters and...
Well, not just that.
New disco.
The reason why the title of this episode is in present tense is because maybe the name died, but that four on the floor beat,
yeah.
and then what now accompanied with like electronic music, that
sure.
never went away.
No, you're right.
It may have faded in the background. Now it's like all over the radio.
Yeah.
It's like Katy Perry stuff and Britney Spears stuff,
ooh.
I'm told. they use the same stuff. It's just disco. It's just a different name for it.
Yeah. At its peak, Josh, 1979, disco was a $4 billion industry,
mm-hmm.
and they claim more than 15,000 discos in the United States.
That's a lot.
So they spread from the cities, clearly, to the Bible Belt, the Rust Belt, the Heartland.
Yeah.
And as we'll get into now, it wasn't very accepted by the white male establishment, a.k.a. rock and roll fans.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And people just kind of, on the surface, it's just because you know, disco and rock. They don't go together, you know. But there's a lot of, like we said at the beginning, cultural critics who say, you know, that people who are into disco didn't think about rock. They didn't care about rock.
No, they were high and dancing.
People who are into rock hated disco.
Yeah.
Why?
It was a threat, they claim, and they were probably very right, to their what they thought were good American values. They didn't like gay people.
Yeah.
Didn't probably like black people and Latinos.
Or women, divas hogging the spotlight.
Yep, because rock and roll in the 19, unless your name is like Patti Smith, it wasn't a big haven for female singers.
Right, or like or Grace Slick. She was backed up by an all-male band.
Yeah.
You know, it was like very rare for like a female lead, and even then,
sure,
it was like the one girl and a guy band, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah, unless you're the Runaways, I guess.
Right.
Which is like, they made a movie about him. It was such a big deal.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That's a good point, Chuck. But for the most part, disco represented everything that was a threat to the white, straight establishment.
That's right.
And that's why a lot of people think that this whole disco sucks movement came about.
Yeah.
So if you are one of those people who's just like, disco sucks, maybe you should reevaluate exactly why you think disco sucks. Is it really just the music? And if it is, hey, man, like, I'm sure that's the case.
Yeah.
But if there's probably a lot of people out there who think disco sucks and don't even know that disco is pretty gay, and maybe that's why you don't like it. Or
yeah,
disco is pretty black, and maybe that's why you don't like it. Or maybe you just hate women. Maybe,
well,
maybe you should go work on your relationship with your mother and then take another listen to disco and see if it sounds any sweeter.
Well, it was the whole lifestyle. It was hedonistic. You had the Village People as sort of the cartoonish face of the gay movement at the time, you know, dressing up and,
yeah,
you know, it was not accepted in these rock and roll circles in the Midwest and in the South, and it just was not cool.
But even in New York or London or wherever, like, you got punk.
Yeah.
Punk people hated disco, but at least they, for the most part, had a legitimate leg to stand on, which was punk was, it tended to be political, and disco was not political at all. So like Mark Mothersbaugh. Is it Mothersbaugh or Mothersbaugh?
Mothersbaugh.
Okay. He apparently went to Studio 54 and had a crazy experience on PCP. But he said that disco was like a dumb girl with good looks and good body.
Oh.
Which is kind of like, it's an apt description, I guess, of disco in a way.
Yeah, that makes sense. So this guy who wrote this book, what's it called?
His name's Peter Shapiro. He wrote Turn the Beat Around, : The Secret History of Disco.
Yeah, he argues, and he makes a pretty good point, that disco was the most democratic musical form ever in the history of music.
Yeah.
Yeah, he said it's the most democratic form of popular music ever conceived. And it really brought about the gay culture into the mainstream.
Yeah.
Even though it wasn't super accepted in all circles, it was the first time it was like in your face, out in the open, we're dancing, and here's the Village People.
Exactly.
Who I used to draw pictures of. I still have one.
Did you really?
Yeah, I still have this crayon photo, crayon drawing that I did of the Village People, and I wore that album out, and I'm sure my parents were like, what's going on here?
I'll bet.
Especially like Stone Mountain, Georgia in like 1975.
You're like, can I dress like a leather daddy for Halloween this year?
I thought the biker guy was the coolest one. I was like, he's so tough.
Yeah, look at that mustache.
I know. Oh, boy. It's funny. It was such an innocent time, you know? For me, at least.
Yeah, it was. That was a good time to grow up unawares.
It was great.
Because you could just love disco.
You didn't know they were on cocaine
agenda.
And Quaaludes and
yeah,
doing all that stuff.
Exactly.
What else you got?
Oh, I think we'd be remiss in mentioning disco's role in hip-hop, like we said earlier.
Oh, yeah.
You may have noticed that whole DJing thing kind of crossed over.
Sure.
And if you doubt disco as a foundation for hip-hop and rap, you need look no further than what 1983, the Sugar Hill Gang's Rapper's Delight.
Yeah.
That's almost all Sheik's Good Times.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a disco anthem.
That's right. You were dead right, sir. And then, of course, its influence on, like we said, all dance music to come, really.
Yeah.
Electronica.
Raves.
I mean, it never stopped.
Yeah.
You can't stop the music.
And I imagine it's going on now. Like, there's probably some very cool underground parties that you and I will never, ever, ever, ever know exist.
Yeah.
That are real basically just disco. Doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Scissor Sisters, I mentioned them. I know there's a lot more bands, but they're really like riffing on that old disco thing.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Hercules and Love Affair, that's a good one.
I don't know them.
They're Anthony and the...
Anthony and the Johnsons?
Yeah, his side project.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's pretty. It's very disco.
I love that guy. Boy, he does such like morose orchestral downbeat
this
stuff.
This is not like that.
Really?
Yeah, that's it's like his other voice. And different. He's got to get out his happiness so he can go do the Anthony and the Johnsons thing.
I'm trying to imagine him happy. That'd be so weird.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm a fan of his. I'll check that out.
Yeah, new disco. It's all over the place.
It is.
If you want to...
Oh, wait, quickly. We should say RIP, because we lost two disco legends recently to cancer.
Oh, yeah, let's hear it.
Donna Summer and Robin Gibb both passed within the past, like, month.
Oh, yeah.
And,
Who will be the third?
Yeah.
The disco third.
Well, there were four, not disco, but four musicians with cancer in, like, the span of 6 weeks. It was sad.
Who?
Well, Adam Yauch and Levon Helm.
Oh, yeah.
Donna Summer and Robin Gibb. It was
That's
like,
right.
Bam, four in a row.
So then who will be the other two?
Yes.
Jeez.
I hope nobody.
I hope not too, Chuck.
Yeah.
So we're done with disco?
We are the Knights on Broadway, and yeah. We are done with disco.
Very nice.
Which sucks.
I
didn't like the music.
You didn't like disco music?
No, it's not. You know, I was listening to rock and roll pretty early on.
I like it. I like it all. But then also I was listening to the Smiths' Death of a Disco Dancer today,
great
too.
Great song.
It's a great song. And it makes you wonder, like, exactly why did that disco dancer die?
That's right.
Huh. If you want to learn more about disco, you can type that in, surprisingly enough, to the search bar at How Stuff Works, and it will bring up this article. And let's see, since I said article, it's time for Chuck's presentation.
Yeah, Josh, in lieu of listener mail, I just got back from Max FunCon.
Woo!
And I'm going to do a little presentation called Max Fun Plug.
Woo!
Because great people are involved and we need to give them their due.
Okay.
Firstly, want to thank Jesse Thorne and recognize Jesse Thorne. Friend of Stuff You Should Know.
The Godfather.
Great guy. He has an empire out there in California.
Mm-hmm.
A podcasting empire, and you can...
Podcasting and knockoff wallets.
Yeah. He's a fashion icon. Jesse, you can go to MaximumFun.org to look up his bag. It used to be The Sound of Young America.
Mm-hmm.
Now his main show is called Bullseye. It's an interview show. It's really great.
We've been on it.
Yeah.
We talked about Mexican wrestling on it.
Was that on Bullseye?
Yeah, it was, wasn't it?
I thought it might have been on Jordan Jesse Go.
Oh, man.
Okay. Well, Jordan Jesse Go, since I mentioned it, is one of his other shows with his partner Jordan, and that's a funnier one. Although they're all funny. But thanks to Jesse, he has this concept that he's built the Maximum Fun empire on called New Sincerity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just great. It's nice people. It eschews cynicism and this ironic crap.
Oh, that's cool.
That everyone does, and it's called New Sincerity. It really says it all.
Did he found New Sincerity? Is it like a lightning bolt or a light bulb that he had?
Yeah.
That's cool.
I mean, you Google New Sincerity, and it comes up as Jesse Thorne's mantra.
I'm going to start taking him more as more sincere then. Yeah. I always assumed he was making fun of me.
No, of course not. He's a very sincere guy. And his wife, Teresa, and little baby Simon were all there, mm-hmm. and they're all doing great, and they're wonderful people. So, Riff Tracks was in the house.
Yes.
Formerly Mystery Science Theater 3000, Josh's Ooh. Heroes, Kevin Murphy and Bill Corbett, Tom Servo and Crow T. Robot.
Yeah.
People, they are fans of Stuff You Should Know.
Yeah.
And I flipped out, emailed Josh, and beyond that, they are literally the two nicest guys I've met so far in show business.
You said that in the email.
Yeah.
I can vouch for that.
They are... the nicest dudes I've ever met in show business so far.
That's awesome.
And that includes John Hodgman.
Ooh. Hodgman's not going to like that.
That's right.
But maybe he'll step it up. I would say Hodgman will take that as a challenge.
You think? Yeah. You can go to Riff Tracks, RIFFTRAX.com. You can buy their stuff. You can buy, look out for Riff Tracks Live. They're awesome and funny and worth supporting for sure.
Yeah.
My brother and me, we were on their show. The McElroy brothers, Justin, Travis, and Griffin, hung out with them a lot. Really super cool dudes. They had their wives and girlfriends with them, and they were all sweet and funny and nice and great people. And they have a great podcast called My Brother and Me. New episodes out every Monday.
Mm-hmm.
You can find that at MaximumFun.org.
Mm-hmm.
Travis, who is the middle bro, co-hosts a show also called In Case of Emergency. That's very funny. And then Justin and his wife, Sydney, have a show called Satellite Dish that's about TV shows. And they're both really funny.
Okay.
It was like literally all six of them were six of the funniest people I've hung around.
That's really cool, man.
I was like, man, Christmas must be a blast.
Yeah.
Around the McElroy.
They don't even get each other presents. They sit around and like delight one another.
Mary Roach was there, author of Stiff, which we've plugged.
Stiff. Boink. Spook.
Bonk.
Bonk.
Spook.
Spook and...
Packing for Mars.
Yeah. What is she like?
She's
great. Cool.
Yeah. I didn't meet her, but I heard her lecture. Yeah. Susan Orlean lectured.
What did she lecture on?
On science-y authoring and cool stuff like that.
Oh, so it was like a workshop.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Susan Orlean was there. She was great.
Orchid Thief lady.
Yep. You know her as Meryl Streep.
Yeah.
I did not meet her, but she was great on stage as well. Josh Bierman, who I met, Joshua Bierman.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of Hodgman's buddies.
Yeah.
He is a writer, and you can find his work in Rolling Stone, Wired, Harper's, This American Life, McSweeney's, HuffPo. He's like all over the place. And he is genuinely one of the delightfully weirdest dudes I've ever hung out with in my life.
Nice.
Like one of those guys just like, man, you are so odd and I want to hug you. Talk to you for hours, that kind of dude.
Hodgman has another friend like that named David Reese, who I met.
He's next on. You met David?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's awesome. I have a David Reese story, may I?
Well, let me set up who he is first.
Oh, okay.
David Rees is he was formerly the cartoonist that you might know from Get Your War On.
Yes.
Great political cartoon and during the Bush years. He is now an artisanal pencil sharpener, and you heard me correctly. He sharpens pencils by hand. He goes on tour teaching this. He has a book that you can buy called How to Sharpen Pencils, and you can go to artisanalpencilsharpening.com. You can send him your pencils. He will sharpen them by hand and return the pencil and the clippings.
And the clippings.
Because the clippings belong to the client.
Yeah.
And it's not a joke, but it is a joke. It's funny, but he's really serious about it.
Well, yeah. I mean, he'll really sharpen your pencils, and he really wrote a book on it.
I'm glad you met him. I didn't know that.
He's a cool dude.
He's awesome. So let's hear the story.
Yumi and I went and saw his book tour show in Brooklyn when we were there a couple weeks ago. And before the show, I was talking to him and Hodgman, and we were all hanging out. And I was like, well, break a leg. And I turned to walk away, and he goes, you too. And I turned around, and he was just glowering at me.
Really?
Yeah. He was a pretty cool dude.
Yeah. He was funny. He had his video on Reddit the other day, and he was posting comments that people were making, like, is this dude serious? Like, I can't tell if this is a joke or not.
Yeah.
But it's both. It's like funny, but he's really, really serious about pencil sharpening.
I think it's just one of those things you just no need to explain it, man. Take it however you want.
Agreed. His class was one of the most popular ones there, though, actually.
Really?
His pencil sharpening.
Was it like a bring your own pencil, or did he provide them?
He provided the pencils and the equipment, but you took home everything.
Nice.
So, yeah, buy David's book, How to Sharpen Pencils. It's excellent. He sent one to me yesterday, actually.
I had to buy mine.
Really?
Yeah, Yumi and I each bought one.
Well, I told him I was going to plug it. You should have. Need to work it.
Eh.
Roman Mars was there.
Yeah. Did you get to meet him, huh?
I didn't.
What?
I couldn't find him.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I meant to tell you. He tweeted that, like, the low point was that he kept missing you. Sorry, I forgot to.
That's so weird. I looked around for him, and I guess we just missed each other.
Yeah.
I emailed him the other day.
He was sad.
So Roman has a design and architecture podcast called 99% Invisible, which is great.
Yeah, he did a cool one about the Twin Towers on the anniversary.
Really?
And it was like he got his hands on like a recording of the sound they made, like swaying.
Wow.
And creaking. It was really cool.
Well, and the cool thing about that show is you don't have to be into design or architecture to think it's an awesome show.
Yeah.
I just encourage you to listen to it. And then the comedians there, Maria Bamford, who's a stalwart at Max FunCon, she's great. MariaBamford.com. Cameron Esposito did the morning trivia with me. She stepped up and co-hosted.
Mm-hmm.
She sports the side mullet, which he has coined that term. Yeah. It's like all shaved on one side and hangs down on the other.
Yeah.
And she is super sweet and very funny. And I'm really rooting for her and her career. It is TheRealCameronEsposito.com.
Mm-hmm.
W. Kamau Bell, WKamauBell.com. He has an upcoming show on FX this fall, his brand new TV show premiering after Louis.
Oh, wow.
So he's like...
He's set.
Kind of crapping his pants right now.
I'll bet.
But very exciting time for him. It was cool to meet him at the stage. And the name of Kamau's show is Totally Biased.
Nice.
And it premieres August 9th at 11 p.m. on FX.
That is a huge plug, Chuck.
Yeah. Steve Agee, did you watch the Sarah Silverman show?
Here or there.
He was one of the neighbors, the two gay guys. He was like kind of a big slovenly dude.
Oh, you're thinking of...
Steve Agee.
Okay.
But he's very funny. And like all the other comedians are doing this very like, not avant-garde, just very interesting sort of different style of comedy. And then he gets up there and starts making like poop and marijuana jokes, which is refreshing for me. You can follow him on Twitter at Steve Agee, that's A-G-E-E, or steveagee.tumblr.com.
Nice.
Chris Fairbanks performed, chrisfairbanks.com. He was really great. Didn't get to meet him, but he was super funny. And, of course, John Hodgman.
Yay.
Follow John at Hodgman. Listen to Judge John Hodgman.
Mm-hmm.
You can buy his books, The Areas of My Expertise, More Information Than You Require. That is all.
And what's his website?
I don't know.
It's not that is all. It's areasofmyexpertise.com, I believe.
Okay. And John stepped up as usual, and we did a fun pub trivia together, and it's just a great time. You know, Haji.
Oh, yeah.
Good dude.
He's a great dude. I'm glad you had a good time, Chuck.
It was fun. And it wasn't quite last year with Upright Citizens Brigade and Andy Richter. Like, that was huge for me just personally. This probably would have been bigger for you because of...
MST3K?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they sent me an email and they said to say hello and that you guys are great.
That is really something.
Yeah.
That is very nice.
So support all these people. Support Jesse Thorne and his empire. They're all good folks doing great work. Couldn't support nicer people.
Yeah. The next time you see a knockoff Gucci wallet being sold on the street, just purchase it because the funds probably go to Jesse Thorne and to provide for his family.
That's right.
Let's see. I don't even know what to call for. Best disco song ever?
Sure.
How about best overlooked disco song ever? Because, yeah, man, we've all heard Fly Robin Fly and all the other ones that we mentioned in this episode.
Nights on Broadway is mine.
Okay. You can tweet to us. You can tweet to us at SYSK Podcast. You can join us on Facebook at facebook.com/stuffyoushouldknow. And you can send us an email, right?
Right.
I'll give that email address in a second. But Chuck, I want to play us out with what I think is the greatest disco song of all time.
All right, let's hear it.
A Taste of Honey's Boogie Yogi Yogi. So you got that playing right now?
Yep.
You can send us an email to stuffpodcast@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?